This week on A to Z Running, we discuss a massive review of the effects of heat and humidity on performance.
We also answer a listener question about prehydrating before races.
In the world of running, as the Summer Olympics approach, we learn more about who will be there, and we've got that for you.
As track action continues, we bring some fast times and interesting analysis.
In recent headlines, is there a link between personality and running mechanics?
All this and more on A to Z Running. Welcome back to A to Z Running, where we help runners thrive with information, inspiration, and coaching services. I'm Andy.
And I am Zach, and you can learn everything you need to know about what we do at atozrunning.com. Follow us on Instagram, YouTube, and Spotify. Those are our main places that we may interact with you.
Yeah. And we love to do so. Speaking of an opportunity that may come up for those in the West Michigan area to come together would be the Deamer 5K, which is a fast, flat 5K in West Michigan coming up on June 8th. It is one of the most competitive 5Ks in Michigan, and it's a lot of fun for the whole family. They even do like a kids steeplechase, which is always adorable. Love to see it. We had Olympic medalist Brian Deamer on the show last year, and he and his family put this race on, and they do a great job. And if you beat Brian Deamer, you get a donut, which is a nice little perk.
There you go.
Except he's pretty fast.
Speaking of people who are pretty fast, some A to Z runner updates for you here, because people are doing stuff, and it's amazing. Congrats to Martha, who finished first overall at the Run Michigan Cheap 10K in Saranac. And her first ever first overall at that distance, at least. Well done, Martha.
Good job, Martha.
Also, Trinity ran the Pittsburgh Marathon, which is always a tough one. So congrats on that. Craig ran the Revel White Mountains Marathon. Laura ran the Flying Pig Half Marathon. Jessica ran the Kalamazoo Half Marathon. Mary ran a 5K.
And won.
First overall. Mm-hmm. And Michelle recently ran the Hurt the Dirt half marathon as well. So lots of performances, lots of running. Congrats on that. And hopefully you saw some of those folks if you were at some of those places as well.
So fun. All right, now let's get on to your questions.
Remember to ask your questions so that we can share them on air and feature your answers, or even if we don't have the opportunity to do so, we will at least share thoughts in response to you. The easiest way to ask questions is go to the email address, or rather send your email to the email address. I don't think you can go to an email address, but you can email questions at atozrunning.com.
This one from Allie: should you preload hydration? And a little bit of context is that she is in marathon training and doing long efforts, and she says that she is a salty sweater, and she tends to...
Is that a diagnosable condition, or is it just like a self-perception if I have salt stains?
Yeah, I think people kind of gather that, but you could also do sweat tests and things.
So then it would be a diagnosable condition.
I guess so. So the answer is, the short answer is yes, but not with just water. Preloading with just water is not great, because then you're actually diluting your blood sodium levels, and you need that sodium. So if you're going to be preloading hydration, it's not just having your water bottle everywhere, it's also taking electrolytes.
Is there a way to know that you're drinking too much water?
That is a really great question. I was going to look that up. Do you know? Are you asking this because you want to talk
about
it?
Well, you have it written right there. If you're going to the bathroom too much, like excessive potty breaks,
yeah,
then you're drinking too much water without the other things. Not to suggest you should slow down your intake of water, but maybe you need more electrolytes with the water.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is just in general, if your urine is clear, like totally clear, then that's a sign that you're overhydrated or under electrolyted.
The real problem is that people are not... they're diluting their sodium levels. That's actually the real danger.
Right. That's why when your urine is totally clear, that's okay. One of the signs.
Okay. So talking about average electrolyte losses, it's so hard. It's really individual. So, but I can give you kind of a roundabout. The average person loses about 800 milligrams of sodium, 195 milligrams of potassium, 20 milligrams of calcium, and 10 milligrams of magnesium per hour when you're running, according to the American College of Sports Medicine.
But that's like a crazy statistic to just call an average, because if it's 20 degrees Fahrenheit versus 90 degrees and relative humidity is very high.
Yeah.
So, or if you're wearing lots of layers or not wearing. So case in point, you lose a lot of electrolytes.
Yeah.
If you're sweating. If you're not sweating, you're not really losing hardly any. So that's a good way to know.
And American College of Sports Medicine recommends that you try replacing at least half of those during the run of an hour or longer for your electrolytes specifically. But this was interesting to me as I was kind of digging into this, wondering about dehydration. There's a lot of athletes who are dehydrated in training and or competition. In fact, a study of 400 amateur athletes, 31%, more than a quarter, came to training sessions dehydrated.
Like dehydrated prior to?
Yes. Came to the session dehydrated, which I know personally that I have done, and I know a lot of people do.
Yeah. Well, that's where the one of the statistics that's really strange is that in general, not in every case, but in certain instances, more deaths from excessive overhydration occur than dehydration deaths specifically. Part of that is because people really don't die very easily from dehydration because your body, you just collapse and faint before you get to the point of like death, and then people can help you out, like take you to an emergency room or something. But point is, the reason that happens is because people show up at the contest underhydrated at the start of it. And so then they're feeling the effects of that early in the competition. And since there's hydration stations all over the place while you're in contest, you can drink all sorts of things. Well, then people start slamming all the beverages because they're feeling dehydrated. But hydration is not something that happens quickly. We'll come back to this later on when we talk about this. And so, like, for instance, your levels of electrolytes and water saturation in your body doesn't, like, if I drink something, it doesn't, like, 10 minutes later immediately all absorb into all the places it should be. It takes time. So if you start to feel dehydrated, it's going to take a while before you stop feeling dehydrated. So that's where you run into the problem where people are going to start drinking something and not feel the immediate effects of that. And so they drink more, and then they drink more. And so, like, every aid station, they're taking stuff. And that could be a problem too. And that can largely be remedied by starting the competition well hydrated.
So this is a great question, Allie, because this is really an important component. You want to get to the start line hydrated. And, of course, having all that you need for resources with your electrolytes before you begin.
Yeah, and in order to do that, you can't just do that the morning of the race or the night before, which would be terrible because you're going to be up all night using the restroom. So instead, like days, not many days, but at least a few days before the competition, start increasing your hydration if you don't already have good hydration day to day, which you should, because as Andy mentioned, apparently people show up on a regular basis to regular training sessions dehydrated, which suggests that in general, their hydration practices are poor.
Yeah, and I just recently, I didn't write this down, so I'm hoping I'm getting this correct, but even 1% dehydration can result in 10% of cognitive, like not being as sharp, 10% of reduction in your cognitive abilities. And that study wasn't talking about running specifically, but like, you know that you need all your whereabouts to get through a marathon. But anyway, that was a little side note. But something you really should be focusing on is that sodium. We had mentioned how important that is. And that's why people take salt tabs and things of that nature. Megan Featherson recommends, actually, if you're a heavy sweater, to take those sodium supplements and like scratch the night before your marathon or like long run. Because you don't want to just take it during the event. You want to be preloaded. So that's what this whole conversation is about, is the prehydration aspect. So That is a suggestion, a very tangible one to take away. Yeah. And this is also another note for like the heavy sweaters. We're specifically talking in context of someone who says that they're a salty sweater. So you'll also want to add more salt to your food. So even like table salt and things of that nature. And this is on a regular basis during training. And especially as we're having warmer months coming up. So it's not uncommon for heavy sweaters to need 2 to 4 times the daily recommendation of sodium.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Now, two other things then to remember, Allie and everyone else, as you're thinking about how do I hydrate ahead of time and be ready so I'm not showing up dehydrated or partially dehydrated before an event. Coffee dehydrates you. I should start this by saying not all liquids are created equal. We've already established that, like water by itself is not enough to hydrate you fully, but also there are some liquids that have a negative effect, net negative on your hydration levels. Coffee is one of them.
But that's not true.
Specifically caffeinated coffee.
No,
it is.
No.
It is.
I read something on that. That
I'm sure you did because there's a lot of coffee lovers out there.
It's a diuretic, but right. It's actually liquid.
Right, because it's a diuretic. It's causing your body to eject nutrients faster. And so you're not absorbing as much. So the net effect is less than positive.
Stop trying to take away something I love.
Also, I'm just kidding. And then even more people are going to hate me for this, but alcohol also dehydrates you. And it causes your body to poorly regulate heat, which is going to come up later when we start talking about heat and humidity. But so when you're getting ready for your race, I don't say don't drink the coffee because that actually is going to have an even worse effect on you if you drink coffee regularly that is caffeinated, because then the caffeine withdrawal is going to cause you problems. So don't cut it out, but account for the fact that if you spend most of your morning, like the first 3 hours of the day, drinking mostly coffee, that should be adjusted. You should improve upon that with better things in addition to. And then the second caveat is if you spend the last 3 hours of your day drinking mostly alcohol, stop. Period. Just don't do that. Well, ever. But also, don't do that in this particular situation as you're getting ready for a race. Cut it completely out of your diet. Best case scenario. Most people say a week, you know, the last week before the race, no alcohol. That's a good practice.
Yeah. So this was actually a perfect question to lead into our main topic, which is about heat and humidity.
As Andy said, it was a perfect segue because we're going to use some of the comments we shared in response to Allie's question to address this topic further as well. But before we do, let's talk about the need, the problem. So last week we were talking about wind and how it affects performance and is really not good. But as it goes, wind is probably, if like a strong wind is probably the worst possible effect on running performance. But also, it's very rarely like a consistent negative effect during a run. Like you're not usually running into the wind the entire time. And so you have respite. And as soon as the wind is gone, that negative effect is gone. It's not like a lasting problem unless you ran super hard into the wind and now you're just fatigued. But the point is, wind might have a greater negative effect than other things, but it's not necessarily the most unpleasant thing. That brings us to humidity and heat, which might be the most unpleasant thing for runners. And we're going to talk a little bit here about what causes the negative effects and in particular, how bad is it truly? And then what should we do about that as we like to do?
We talk about on the show quite a bit of being able to plan for your races and having good amounts of information to make decisions and not being surprised by things. I always go back to Alicia Munson saying she imagines every scenario and how she will overcome them. So in this conversation, you might be like, wah, wah, humidity, but it's going to be helpful to us to be able to get the most out of ourselves on a humid day.
True that. And it's really interesting, in particular, one of the studies. So we mined Runners Connect again, because as I was looking at the wind article last week, we happened upon this humidity article as well. And what I was looking for is where did they get their information? Because I'm always curious, you know, where does the information come from? And so we've got a couple of studies here to share that address from a couple different angles the topic. And I think it's going to be enlightening for many of us. So we already know that humidity is bad. Runners Connect article specifically spent a moment reflecting on whether dry heat and wet heat humidity are consistently better and worse. And it is the case that humidity is worse than dry heat. But what's interesting is that perception, like relative perception reported, is not always the same. And I think that might just depend on which climate you are more used to. So if you're more used to a dry climate, humidity is awful for you. Like, it's going to just wreck you in your self-perception. It's also going to wreck you in performance. But if you're comfortable in a humid environment, which we are, we spend our summers are very humid. When I go to like dry heat, I think I'm dying without doing anything. And yet, statistically, I should still perform better than I would even in my familiar environment. So that's where you get like, these things, depending on what they're looking at in the study, you get some interesting results. However, we're going to try to distill what we are talking about today to as raw performance data as we can distill it to and share that with you. So first, the first study was looking at a specific selection of runners and putting them through, this is the classic study scenario, putting them through the rigmarole of here's an experience with more humidity, here's an experience with less, things like that. And I want to share with you the title, so because one of the comments I'm going to make later on in the episode is whenever people are sharing studies, it's always good to like do our own background reading. You know, you can certainly trust people that you feel like you can trust, and that's fair and fine. But so often it is the case that we share something like a study, and whether we are interpreting things not completely or whether we are sharing only part of it and there's another part that is important to the thing, who knows? There's a lot of different reasons why people use studies and abuse them. But if you are at all concerned ever about us doing that, we will give you the study so you can always find it yourself. And this one comes from the journal called Temperature, published in 2016. Title is The Effects of a Systematic Increase in Relative Humidity on Thermoregulatory and Circulatory Responses During Prolonged Running Exercise in the Heat. This is why these are studies and not like news articles on a website.
It's very long.
All right, so you can get the gist of it from the title, which, you know, a well-titled study tells you everything you need to know before you start reading it. So they increased humidity. This was in a controlled environment, and they wanted to find out predominantly what happens to our body and draw conclusions about how that might affect performance. So they did not specifically try to measure much in terms of performance outcomes, except for a couple key things. And these are naturally very important ones. So they took different humidity scales, like around 20%, 40%, 50%, and I think it was like 70 or something was the next one. And then they measured things like skin temperature, internal temperature, which they measured in a very unpleasant way. Props to the people who volunteered for this to be willing to go through that. And then they also measured a couple of other things like heart rate stuff and stroke volume and such. And so as the humidity increased, everything got worse, right? But the thing that was the most interesting is they looked at time to exhaustion, and they did the classic test. This was runners again, remember. They put them on a treadmill on a set speed and then increased the incline 2% every certain increment of time, and 2% more, 2% more, until you report like, I can't go on. Now, remember what we said about humidity and like people feel worse than they maybe even are. This is why this metric is especially interesting, because one of the things they find with the humidity is that there's kind of like a break point where after is about between 40 and 50% humidity, where all of the measured things like temperatures and stroke volume with your heart and such, they have a kind of like a slight jump, a bump that happens in that period of time. And in the same period of time, everyone's time to exhaustion dramatically decreases and then keeps going down through the rest of it. So humidity makes us less capable of performance, right? We kind of already knew that, but where is there like a, is there a line somewhere that seems to have, well, once you get beyond about 45% humidity, then we're talking, it's likely to increase those effects. Not exponentially, but some kind of bump. Okay. So that was an interesting study. But the next one was far more fascinating to me because, and this is one that we went out and found ourselves as we were kind of looking through this, because of what they did, what they studied. So these people, these folks of published in Medicine and Science in Sports and Exercise in 2022, recent publication, the title of the study is Effects of Weather Parameters on Endurance Running Performance, Discipline-Specific Analysis of 1,258 races. And which races are those? That's what's so interesting. They looked at Olympics, World Championships, Diamond Leagues, World Marathon Majors, and any other World Athletics Gold Cup label races. So they looked at the upper echelon of competitions. And they're talking about like 7,800 athletes, right, who are the world's best athletes within these disciplines. They looked at steeplechase, 3,000 meters, and then 5,000, 10,000, marathon. And then they also did the race walks, the 20K and 50K race walks, which is relevant because that's where the humidity effects are the worst.
And that's long.
They're very long distance events. Yep. Yeah. Very long events. And it takes an even greater toll on them than anybody else. So that's tough. But so they looked at the world's finest athletes from 1936 until 2000, something like that. And you have to now assume, okay, these people are for these events, because these are not just like everyday events. These are like the big important ones. They are clearly training for those events. They're acclimating for them. They're going through all the fancy tricks you can do to be ready to compete in these conditions. Now, knowing all of that, what effects do humidity and temperature have on these athletes? And it's crazy. It's really, really interesting.
Tell us, Zach. Tell us.
Well, okay. So the main takeaway is after looking at all these data, they found that performance declined for every degree outside of the ideal. And the degree,
like temperature,
yes, but the temperature is including, so they were using the wet bulb globe temperature thing,
uh-huh,
which includes humidity, temperature, and something else. I can't ever remember what the third one is. And so it's all of those things combined into one measurement. And with every degree outside of the ideal, and I'll tell you what the ideal is in a moment too, they measured 0.3 to 0.4% performance decline. So we're talking about 10 degrees outside of the ideal is 3 to 4% performance loss, which is huge. That's huge. First of all, that's exactly what the super shoes claim that they're giving you. And so it's, you lose your super shoe advantage when you're 10 degrees outside of the ideal. Go ahead.
I was just thinking about how that'd be rough. Pre-super shoes, I guess I remember those humid days and those cardboard thin flats. That was even harder.
That was rough.
Not having the spring in your step and being in a humid race.
Yeah, not very pleasant. So there was more to it. There's more to it there, which you start to kind of double down on the findings, and there's just so many interesting layers here. For instance, marathon, as you might guess, has a different window of ideal than like 5,000 and 10,000. It's a little bit cooler. Marathoners don't mind the cool weather quite as much as the track racers in terms of performance. But at the same time, the ideal temperature is warmer than most people think. That was the other thing that I thought was really kind of strange. And so we're talking about like the 50 to 60 degree range, where most people are talking about like 40 to 50s or sometimes even cooler. Now, individual variation matters here, of course, as you might guess. But we're also talking about the world's greatest athletes. And so in this case, individual variation might not be as much of a factor because predispositions tend to be more similar for the world's best. In terms of like, it's a more homogenous group. If we just looked at every runner everywhere, then you're getting a ton more variety in terms of what I'm comfortable with, what I can handle and not handle. But when you take the upper athletes across the board of everything, they tend to have similar capacities, which makes sense because they are, you know, the world's finest. for a reason. But more than that, they did not, and this was distressing to me. I was really hoping they would do this, and they didn't. I'm not sure why. Maybe because they don't understand what someone like me would have wanted to know from the study. But they didn't give us event-specific breakdowns of these data. And so you don't get to see exactly what all of the different measurements had for just the marathon and just the 5,000 meters.
That would have been interesting.
Right. But they do give you some event-specific conclusions, which is helpful. For instance, the 10,000 is affected substantially less by temperature increases than the 5,000, which to me struck me as odd until you think about, and this is the important part, remember we're talking about the world's finest athletes, which matters here, but the 10,000 and the 5,000, the distinct difference between the two is the 5,000 is run at VO2 max. You're beyond your aerobic capacity for most of that race. The 10,000 is just beneath VO2 max until the late stages. And so that difference, I think actually now it makes way more sense that you would probably be affected by heat less than the 10,000 because you're not maxing your systems out quite as much until a brief period in the end.
And that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, that's my supposition, but they didn't specifically try to draw that conclusion. So here's what you get. You get a clear sense that humidity has a major effect. And if you started putting the numbers together, there's calculators out there that are largely based on these kinds of numbers that try to tell you, like, if the humidity is this and the temperature is this, here's what's going to happen to you. Now, that's where we get into, like, yeah, that's possible. It gives you an idea of what the effect might be, but you individually are not affected the same way as anyone else individually out there. And moreover, there's a lot more confounding factors.
And in Michigan, there's nothing as unreliable as the weather. So if you go looking at all of the data beforehand, before a race day, and you're planning what things might be, and then they change the morning of, because that's what happens.
Yeah. The other thing to note is pretty consistently across studies that looked at these demographics in particular, men are affected less by humidity than women. And high performance athletes are affected less than recreational runners, which, like I said, they're acclimated precisely for an event. It makes sense that they would be affected less. So that being the case, these numbers that they gave are based on the world-class athletes. So you can assume for the rest of us, it's probably higher. The net negative effect is higher, which is even more distressing. So now, we like to give the bad news first and then try to do something about it, like we did with the wind episode. If you missed that one, go listen to that last week. So what now? What?
Well, I mean, one of the things that we talked about already in the listener question is, what can you do about it? Well, let's control the controllables. Hydrate well.
Yeah.
Include those good electrolytes. As Zach said, excluding alcohol and maybe copious amounts of caffeine, or not just caffeine, coffee.
Yeah. And just remember that it takes time to hydrate well. And so good to anticipate over a number of days. Now, what we have to keep in mind as we present these suggestions, something like that one, you're going to say, well, aren't the world-class athletes doing that already? And they're still getting the negative effects. We're not giving you suggestions that get rid of that negative effect. We're giving you suggestions to help you endure that negative effect better. Mm-hmm. Let's look at it like that. So that's a good one. Mm-hmm. Be better hydrated.
It seems to me that when there's like shakeups in these world-class races, for instance, the Olympics in Tokyo, for instance, it is those that execute a good race plan and temper their expectations of what kind of time they might be able to run to the race itself in the day and what they're given. If you didn't notice, you know, Molly Seidel didn't come in as one of the top candidates, but she ran a great race.
Yeah. Yep. So you got to do that. The most important thing to remember when we're starting a hot race is that we cannot physiologically perform as well as we could in ideal conditions. Like your body, even if you are well acclimated, your body cannot perform as well in extreme conditions as it can in ideal conditions. So that should inform our expectations. We should not be starting that race, especially something like a marathon. We should not be starting that race thinking, but I'm still going to hit my paces, because you never know. Something miraculous might happen. Well, I guess that's possible. That's true. Something miraculous actually could happen, but don't do that. You're just setting yourself up for a really unpleasant experience. But not everyone's affected the same way, and so we have to keep that in mind. And the case in point that we were just recently sharing was we had a number of athletes running Boston this year, and one in particular that shared with me. He said the heat, it wasn't too bad. You know, a lot of people are saying it was pretty rough, and he's like, oh, it wasn't too bad. And I said to him, but don't you think that part of why you felt that way is because you spent the 2 months prior to Boston in Florida? And he goes, oh, yeah. Well, no, he already knew that. He already knew that was having a positive effect on his Boston experience in the heat. So that brings us to something we'll talk about in a moment. But before we get to it, it is important to remember that high heat and humidity, rather, when our body starts to heat up, it isn't the kind of thing that, like, oh, I'm starting to get too hot, I should just kind of ease off a little bit and then I'll be fine. Once you begin overheating, when your body begins the literal process of overheating, which I believe is a measurable phenomenon, but I don't know exactly what the line might be. But there are stages of overheating. Once you start entering those stages, you don't come back from that very easily or quickly. Like, we're talking some of the stages, once you get to like stage 2 or 3, like heat exhaustion or heat cramping, it's the other order actually, heat cramping and then heat exhaustion. Now we're talking about days before your body fully recovers from that. And so the idea of overheating is like, avoid that at all costs. That means that if you have to go substantially slower to make sure that you're not overheating because you're feeling like you're getting there, you gotta slow down, because as soon as you start overheating, you're in the danger zone, and it's not gonna get any better, and it's gonna get a whole lot worse, more likely. Mm-hmm. So temper your expectations.
You knew I was gonna say it, but we gotta take a positive spin on things. Just like I was talking about with the winds last week, we have to find the benefits and see those challenges as ways that are gonna actually help us grow. And there are adaptations that we get from running in humidity. So when we enter into a season where the humidity increases and we're starting to feel badly because we're like, oh man, I feel like I'm slowing down, having a harder time recovering. And that is frustrating. But if we're able to see that as a challenge, it's going to help us adapt and get better as a runner, then I think that we're going to have a better outlook on it. Like, we go and find hills to run on. We're runners, people. We actually look for discomfort. So I think that we, if anyone can reframe humidity, I think it's a group of runners. I think it's you, whoever you are that's listening right now. So remember that running in humidity, called heat training, has the ability to increase plasma volume and reduce cardiovascular and thermoregulatory strain, because over time you actually adapt. And people have likened it similar to like altitude training, which is a little bit different, but there are some of the same benefits, can help you grow your fitness. And once you reduce oxygen levels, like in the altitude training, you're straining your system, and then your body has to actually learn to cool itself better to maintain optimal functioning. So you gain cardiovascular strength because your heart has to work harder, and you become more efficient.
Especially if you have to compete in the heat. And that's so the heat adaptation side of things, which is that's where the question always comes at this point in time, is like, if you have to race, for instance, in February in warm climate, and you're used to living in Michigan, which is not warm.
I wonder where you got this example.
It just so happens that it's going to be really hard on your body, even if it's not terribly hot. Anything beyond those ideal conditions, chances are it's going to be rough. And by the way, ideal for your body coming from cold climate is not the same as ideal for your body coming from a hot climate. And so in that situation, heat adaptation takes heat acclimatization, you could say, takes like 2 to 4 weeks. It's not a quick thing. And as such, the heat training benefits increase substantially, begin to increase after that 2 to 4 week period. So that's the same thing with altitude training. They always talk about this. If you want to get the benefits of altitude training, you got to be there at least a month. Otherwise, you're only barely beginning to benefit from it when you leave. And that's the old, like, yeah, we took a vacation in Colorado for a week and we were in the Rockies and I thought I'm going to get some good altitude training in. No, really, you're just kind of exhausting yourself extra for a while and your body's not really adapting yet in that amount of time. But so keep that in mind. Next time you think I'm going to get some good altitude training, better to keep it easy and not just be totally spent for your whole vacation. But it is possible. And that's with heat, as with many things, it takes a little bit of time, but it is possible. And more to the point is that when that happens, there's a substantial swing in what your body can do in terms of performance within those ranges. So all hope is not lost.
That's why people run really fast fall marathons and races.
That's one of the reasons. Yeah. It helps.
It does. It helps. All summer long.
So beyond all of that, it's important to remember with weather conditions of any kind and all kinds and such, that, you know, we do our best with it, but we really want to understand efforts well. And that's what's going to get us through to the end with these kinds of things. And we say it often enough here that you don't need to hear us say it again. But your watch is your greatest enemy in all of these scenarios, because your watch is telling you things that you don't want to know, but you can't do anything about. And that's just simply a bad place to put your mental state. Things you would rather not know, but can't do anything about. What's the point in knowing them? So find a way to bridge that gap. And if it means throwing away your watch, we won't blame you. How's that sound?
Sounds good.
Great.
Next time you're running in humidity, embrace it, know that you're getting fitter, and go by effort.
Right on. And think of Zach, who loves running in humidity.
He does, actually, weirdly. I love it.
It's just sweating profusely is just a wonderful experience.
Okay.
Anyway, now let's move on to the world of running.
Kicking things off in the world of running, we're talking about the Olympics because we like to get excited about it, keep you up to date on it. It makes it even more fun when the Olympics occur and you've been following along.
Be informed.
Be informed. It's so much more fun. Kenya announced its marathon teams, and this was long awaited. People have been speculating on it, of course, as one of the top, well, the top marathoning country. People are like, who's going to be on the team? There's so many choices.
We should always, winners. We should always give the caveat. They're the top men's marathoning team. Ethiopia is the top women's marathoning team.
So let's start with the men. Speaking of which, Eli Kipchoge is on the team, starting with the big headliner.
Not a big surprise, but not necessarily a guarantee.
It was not a guarantee. Although he's still running well. He's the two-time Olympic champion. So as the defending champion, it's not surprising that he's on the team.
And he did win Berlin less than a year ago.
Right.
So it's not like Kipchoge is like out of steam.
He's
fading fast. Now, he had a bad Tokyo marathon, if anyone was paying attention to that one. But Kipchoge has not been invincible in the last few years now. And so having a bad marathon here and there, that's going to happen because now he's like human.
In fact, I think that was actually his quote from a different race that he ran poorly. He's like, well, I'm human.
Finally, because he certainly wasn't for about eight years.
Thanks for the clarification. Yeah. Well, I want to kind of hype it up a little bit, Kipchoge, because there are a few things that him being part of this team opens the possibilities for historically. So just racing in Paris, this is what he will accomplish. If he can get to the starting line healthy, he'll be the oldest Kenyan to compete in track and field at the Olympics. So all of track and field.
No kidding.
Yes. First Kenyan in any sport to compete in 5 Olympics.
Right on.
5 Olympics. That's a lot of Olympics.
Oh, never mind. This comes up later. Keep going.
Oh, by the way, I should give credit to Let's Run because these were their observations.
Okay, yes.
what Kipchoge could accomplish with a medal. So if Kipchoge gets a medal in the Olympic marathon, he'll be the first person to earn 3 Olympic marathon medals.
Yep, true.
First men's track and field athlete to medal in 5 Olympics.
Wait, he's medaled in all of them?
Yes.
I did not realize that.
Yes.
I thought he missed one.
Nope.
Okay.
What Kipchoge could accomplish with a gold medal. So if he wins again, he'll be the oldest runner to win Olympic gold in any event.
Wait, even over the throws?
Well, I don't know who Nick Sicardi is.
He's a hammer thrower.
Okay, so maybe he did. So this would be a running event.
Okay.
First person to win 3 Olympic marathon golds.
Yep.
Yeah.
That happened.
Think about that.
Yep.
First runner to win global titles 21 years
apart. That's what
apart.
I was getting at. Yep, there it
is. You were excited for that one, weren't you?
Yeah, his first global title. No, sorry. Yes, title. His first global title was in 2003 at the World Championships. By the way, I think he was 18 years old when he did that. Let's do the numbers. 21 plus 18 is 39. Yes, he was 18 years old when he won the 5,000. And this is what's crazy. If you know anything about your track history and you know who was on top of the world in the year 2003, the 18-year-old Eliud Kipchoge beat Kenenisa Bekele,
wow,
and Hisham El Garouche.
No way.
In that race.
As an 18-year-old?
As an 18-year-old. And they were like kings. Now, LG was like on the way out by then. He was on the way out for sure by then. But Bekele was like
entering his glory
at that time. And Kipchoge beat them. That was cool. It was crazy.
That's exciting. Yeah. So 21 years apart. Some of you listening are not even 21 years old.
There you go.
And then also on the team, so I'm going to move away from Kipchoge to Benson Kipruto, who was the Tokyo Marathon champion.
Yeah.
Again, unsurprising, but there's so many to choose from, so we're announcing it.
He's been top 3 in every marathon major he's run in like the last few years. So
Alexander Matiso was the London Marathon champion.
Mm-hmm.
So they only pick champions, apparently.
Well, when you have so many to choose from. And you have so many to choose from. Yeah.
The alternate is Timothy Kiplagat, mm-hmm. who was second in Tokyo this year. He's run 202.50. He ran 202.55 at Tokyo.
Isn't it interesting
like,
to think?
That's so fast.
A sub 203 marathoner is an alternate for the Kenyan national
team.
That's
wild.
Yeah. And you say that, but at the same time, you also could say, but the GOAT, Eliud Kipchoge, was also almost an alternate for the team.
Yeah.
And so that's the caliber of what's going on here with the Kenyan men's team. And the reason why some have said possible controversy around Kipchoge being chosen is because Kenya has a history of some controversial picks for their team. Because remember, they just choose them. There's no specific criteria. But more to the point, Kenya, who is sponsored by Nike as a mm-hmm. national team, has a tendency whenever they have controversial picks for those picks to be in favor of Nike athletes. And by a tendency, I mean always. It's always a Nike athlete that everyone seems like is not deserving. So that's why people are saying like, well, Kipchoge is a Nike athlete. Yeah, there was no way he wasn't getting picked. He's also Kipchoge, which is the biggest yeah. part of that reason. But he definitely is not getting picked, is not having someone picked over him who is like an Adidas runner or something, which I believe Kiplagat's also Nike, but I don't know.
Well, that story will be woven into the women's, which there were some controversy
more
surrounding.
Controversy,
yes,
for sure.
There's a lot of discussion, but not about Helen O'Beery because
easy.
She
pick.
Was a very easy pick, 2-time Boston, and then NYC champion. So amazing.
O'Beery's run 4 marathons. She's finished top 3 in all 4 of them. 3 of them she's won, and they are the last 3 in a row.
Yeah.
There's never been an easier choice for an Olympic team by any country.
Especially such difficult runs. I mean, Boston and NYC are both
she runs the
hardest courses.
I wonder if that's on purpose. So this is a Dathan thing, right? I'm sure he is part of he does coach her, but I'm sure he's part of her advisement around which races to run. I'm sure he's not the only, like she's not
agent.
Just saying, Dathan,
sure
what should
the
I
agent
run?
Is
right.
As well.
And she's probably thinking about it herself, like which ones she would want to do. But so the likes of, you know, Kipchoge and like the women's previous marathon world record holder, Bridget Koske, They run what you could say are like the fast races, the easy ones, which is true.
There's
they are
no such thing as easy marathon.
No, but they are easier. Helen O'Beardy only has run the hard one so far, and you've got to think that's got to be on purpose.
Yeah.
Like,
I think so.
Got to be.
I mean, especially with what they're saying about Paris.
Yeah,
she's
well,
preparing herself.
She's way more prepared for Paris than anybody else.
A difficult course and be a champion.
Carry on.
Yes. Perez Cheptegei, reigning Olympic and London Marathon champion. She's amazing.
After winning London, there was no doubt she was going to get picked. She was already a likely candidate for the Kenyan women. She was an easy choice.
The reigning Olympic champion.
Yep.
That's great press.
Now, too. On the women's side of things, no woman has won more than one marathon in the Olympics.
I didn't know that little fun fact.
So, much like Kipchoge, if she wins this race, she also does a thing that has never been done before. So, there you go.
The next one was a very controversial choice.
Yep.
Brigid Kosgei. We mentioned her because she's a former record holder, but has not been able to put together a good marathon in a while. A
couple of years.
Yeah.
Yep. Like really not good.
Yeah. DNFs and a couple like out of even 10th.
Well, she's got like a year in the last couple of years that she was like out the whole year with injury.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not looking great. So who is she chosen over though? Why is that a bad choice?
That's why we're, you know, that's why it's controversial because there's a couple shining stars right now. Rosemary Wanjiru. She was second in Tokyo. She's run 2:16:14, which is the fastest time by a Kenyan woman since I don't know when.
This year.
Oh, this year.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, maybe just.
And last year she ran 2:16 and change, I think, as well at Tokyo.
Yeah, she did.
So.
She did. Yep. It was, it was mid 2:16s.
Yep.
So fastest time coming in for selection, you know, if you're looking at all these credentials and you're like, okay, well, we have the fastest one here. Well, she wasn't chosen. The fastest woman was not chosen. And then we just mentioned her because the Boston Marathon, Sharon Lachetti.
Mm-hmm.
Head-to-head in New York in November.
Against Kosgei,
and she beat her.
Yep.
And then she was second in Boston this year to Helen O'Beary, and Helen O'Beary gave her like a standing ovation for that.
Which was second to Helen O'Beary in New York as well, right?
Oh, right. That would make sense.
So, and Sharon Lachetti won the New York Marathon the year that Helen O'Beary was third, which is the year before that. So, Lachetti's got a great track record also on difficult courses.
Right.
Keep in mind, if Helen O'Beary weren't a marathoner in the last 2 years, Sharon Lachetti would have 3 World Marathon Majors titles.
That's true.
In the last 2 years. Like, that's huge.
Yeah.
And she was left off the team.
Mm-hmm.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. So, Brigid Kosgei is not a bad choice, but for her stunning country woman, she is not the obvious choice, and there is argument that maybe she's not the best choice for this one in particular. However, again, I said I was going to weave this thread of the Nike thing going on. Rosemary, neither of them are Nike-sponsored athletes. Neither is Helen O'Beary or Perez Cheptegei. So there'd be no Nike representation. There'd be no Nike athlete if those women went.
Yeah.
So Kosgei is the only Nike runner of that group. And so there's speculation that one of the reasons that she was chosen was to satiate the Kenyan national sponsor, Nike.
Yep, it seems likely, given the history of Kenya choosing Nike athletes in controversial ways. Yeah.
Kosgei's really a great runner, but
she is.
It might have not been the best choice.
Well, we'll find out.
We'll see. Maybe she'll win, and then we'll all shove our
feet
in our mouths.
Or maybe she won't end up running it because she will be injured. She could be injured right now. It's hard to know.
Would they choose her, though, if she was injured?
Well, maybe.
Oh, so it's like a publicity stunt. Like, oh, she's injured. And actually, Sharon Lachetti, who is the alternate, by the way, P.S., I don't. Lachetti is the alternate. Maybe she'll be running. And it just needed to be staged this way. Who knows? Oh, How thrilling.
So much as we described with the Kenyan contingent, the male contingent for the Kenyans in general, it's true that you're leaving someone, no matter who doesn't join the team or selected for the team, you're leaving the world's finest runners at home, which right. is just a wild and crazy thing.
Yep. You're leaving sub 203 marathoners at home.
Or in this case, Rosemary Wanjiru, a 216 marathoner.
Or a 216
multiple time
woman.
216 marathoner. Yeah, that's it. That's how it goes. Well, speaking of Olympic updates, let's go to the track for a little bit. And one of these in particular is just a quick shout out to the ninth grader from Texas who ran a new ninth grade fastest 800 meter time. Remember, he's in ninth grade. So he's like
a
15
child.
Years old. And he ran under 150 in the 800 meters.
That's wild.
Under 150. And what's even more wild is how it happened. The first 600 meters of the race, he just looked like everybody else. He was just with everybody else. And he looked like a fast high school 800 meter runner. And then the last 200, he looked like a 200 meter runner. He turned on so fast and for so dramatically that no one else was even in anywhere near him when he finished, not even close to him. He put seconds on them in 200 meters. That's wow. All right. So we'll see how that career unfolds. But now everyone's watching this kid from Texas who runs really fast in the 800.
Then the Oxy meet, which I've been to before because you raced at it.
Yeah, did that once a long, long time ago.
Yeah.
That's a fun one because it's small. It's at Occidental, which is why they call it the Oxy High Performance Meet in California. And it's very small. And it's not that you don't have to technically be invited to it, but it's not like a meet that everyone's registering for and stuff. They'll have a race with 20 people in it. And, you know, if you're not one of the fastest 20 people who ask to be a part of the race, you're not going to do it. And so in that case, this is one of those where like you get a lot of the top performers in the US coming to this meet, but it's not a big like hype thing. And so performances aren't crazy here. No one's ever running super, super fast times. A lot of times it's like someone's just trying to get a qualifier in for some other event, and it's a good opportunity for rubbing shoulders.
I think it was this event, the Oxy one, when you ran it, that I was starstruck because Ryan and Sarah Hall were there. Sarah was running the steeplechase. I think it was this one.
And Galen Rupp and Mo Farah.
Yeah, I mean, everybody
was there. Yeah,
I was a little starstruck because I was like right by them. I was like, whoa.
It was a little surreal because I'm jogging my warm-up or cool-down or something after the steeplechase or before the steeplechase, and I'm just jogging around the infield of the track. And I'm like trying not to bump into Galen Rupp and Mo Farah and the Halls and like everybody. I mean, it's just everybody was there. And I totally did not belong in that. And I also ran poorly in the race too, which makes it even worse. I didn't lose, but not great. So it was fun. But anyway, point is, we're not talking about Zach years and years ago in the steeplechase. We're talking about the 1500 meters. And I've been telling you, and it just this further corroborates my opinion that the race of the year is going to be the United States Olympic Trials 1500 meter final. I mean, the Olympics is going to be great. Don't get me wrong. But the U.S. Olympic Trials 1500 is going to be electric.
Yeah.
So good.
There's no way that anyone can call with like being definitive about it, the top three.
No. Like you can't even guess within like a margin of error right now.
Right. You can't say, oh, these five people. Like,
right?
You would think, okay, these five people are shoo-ins for like the three spots.
No, I think you got to pick 10. I think you have to pick 10 people before you get to the point of like, yeah, those 10 are definitely candidates.
That's the depth we're talking about.
So this further corroborates that because at Oxy in the 1500, what ended up happening was just absurd. And so we've been talking about who are the who's who, and we've been starting to name names and trying to kind of give you an idea of people to pay attention to. We mentioned Colin Salmon of NAU, the youngster in the crowd, is running under 3:34 as a collegian, which is crazy, and that's really good and fast. But then Nico Young, his teammate, but also legendary Nico Young. He is legendary now. He is.
Even though he's so young.
Yeah. Well, he's not as
when
young.
When can you actually be officially a legend?
I don't know. I think Nico Young's like 22 though, isn't he?
That's very young to be a legend.
Anyway, so he was in the race, these guys, the NAU teammates and such. But everyone's been talking about Centro. Matthew Centrowitz has basically said this is his last year. He's done running after this, which makes sense. He keeps getting hurt. He's getting older. He's not winning races anymore. Well, everyone's like, yeah, but Centro's already done. There's just no way he's a factor. Except he looked good in this race, and he finished well.
It was a Centro finish.
It wasn't quite the fire of a Centro finish, but it was better than anything you've seen in the last couple of years. So Centro looks good, which is really something. I can say a lot of things. But anyway, so as the race unfolded in the final lap, things got crazy. There were like six guys all together. And then it was actually Colin Salmon, the youngster, in a field like this, right? So he's got like his teammate Nico, but he's also got Centro, Craig Engels, Abdi Nur, all pretty much legendary runners already for the U.S. scene. And Colin Salmon's the one like leading the charge in the final lap. And I'm like, go, Colin. What a thing to do. So he's going. Nico Young is challenging him on his shoulder. And Salmon won't relent. And they get to the final straightaway. And the two of them run away from the rest of this field, which is just mind-boggling. But not like crazy. They ended up gaining a second on everyone in the last 100. But Nico Young wins the race, which is a total shocker in this at this point. Who's going to win the race of all of these great kickers and stuff? And well, Nico Young's developed his kick. We've all acknowledged that now, and he just further proved it.
Yeah.
So Young wins the race, 3:34. It's not a crazy fast time, but it's quick, and that I believe is the personal best for Nico Young, at least. Centro had a great finish, just a little ways off of the guys. Salmon was second. And then beyond that, you start running the numbers and you come up with a really strange statistic.
What?
So how many people have run under 27 minutes in the 10,000? The answer is not very many. It's like 70 ever in the history of time. Actually, I think it's 73 if we want to be precise. Under 27 minutes in the 10,000. That's not very many. But how many of those 73 people have also run under 3:35 in a 1500? The answer is even fewer. It's not a big crowd, like a dozen. Now, how many of those same people have also run under 150 in an 800 and it gets even fewer? But here's what's crazy. How many of those people have run under 27 minutes in a 10,000, under 13 minutes in a 5,000, under 3:35 and under 150 in the same season? That's the statistic. We already know that Nico Young did because we're talking about him right now. The answer is one other runner in the history of time has done that in one season. And by the way, that other runner is the 1990s GOAT, Haile Gebrselassie. So
it's Gebrselassie, like the Gebrselassie.
Yeah.
Which then you're like Nico Young? Is in leagues with this greatness?
That's what that everyone's like on the message boards, which is where this came up. Someone found this information and shared it on the message boards. And
so accuracy could be flawed.
No. They were corroborated. Okay. But by a lot of people, because everyone's like, no, that can't be right. Well, here's what it amounts to. Of course, that's very impressive. Very, very impressive. It's also interesting to say things like only Haile Gebrselassie has ever done that. But you already know that plenty of other, I mean, like all of them, all those other runners who have done those fast times and different events could have done it in one season. It's not that they couldn't have. It's that they didn't for whatever reason. And so, yes, true that it puts him on a level with the world's greatest, but we already knew he was on that level because he's run under 27 minutes in a 10,000. There's only 72 other runners ever who have done that. So you gotta already say Nico Young is up there now. He's in the upper echelon. But he also happens to have this cool stat. So own it. Own it, Nico. Not that he listens to A to Z Running. But we got one more thing to share. And it's fascinating and well worth spending a few minutes talking about.
I feel like it is definitely an attention grabber. So in the headlines, links between personality and running mechanics? Question mark?
Question mark.
Question mark.
We need to throw a few question marks. Are there? And if there are they legitimate? So this is the claim. The claim is that your Myers-Briggs personality results.
Which one is that?
Can
me?
Predict. I'll explain.
Okay.
Can predict certain things about your running mechanics. That's what the authors of this study are claiming. Now, first, we heard about this, read about it rather, on Runner's World. I'm not going to shout out Runner's World for this because I have a lot of negative things to say about the article. And I'm not going to go into all of them because Andy does not like it when Zach is too cynical.
I don't.
But the point is, they needed to do a little bit more homework before they published this article because it's not a good look. All right, so first thing to note, the study looks at Myers-Briggs personality test, which is the four traits with the, like, are you introvert, extrovert?
Well, I've that's done not that one.
But the sensor, intuitor, the judger, perceiver, it's all of those matches, right? You end up with 16 combinations and you're one of them. So that was the personality test. They gave 80 runners the personality test and then did a running test with them. And they were evaluating a number of things. And I should note that at the very least, their equipment and evaluative process for the running mechanic, that was pretty good. So that's really interesting. But the rest of it's awful. And here's why it's awful. I'm kind of leading the witness here because I should
give you the information,
let you decide. But they did, for the running test, 3 50-meter intervals for the runners. Okay. And that somehow is representative of those runners' running mechanics. And I got to tell you, everyone here who knows anything about running knows that 50 meters ain't showing you what you really run like. It's showing you what you're starting to do when you're beginning to move. So, like, as soon as I saw that, I was like, really? 50 meter intervals? And now, granted, they did a warm-up jog, which is good. Actually, they didn't say jog. They did a warm-up of whatever effort the people wanted to run who did it. So now already you're corrupting your own data. Well, it's, people do this, and it's like you gave it away in your study. They specifically say, we had them do this 10-minute warm-up and told them they could do whatever effort they want. Well, now you're corrupting your data because depending on how they warmed up, it's going to produce different results in their running mechanics.
Especially if they're looking at bounciness,
right?
Board lean.
Right. So anyway, I digress. This study was bad. But the other thing that's really fascinating here is that they recruited these athletes and began the study in 2014, and did not publish until 2024. This was not a difficult study to conduct. It was pretty simple. Why did it take them 10 years to publish? My guess is because no one wanted to publish this. But that's speculation.
And you're still being cynical. Let's move on.
Yeah. Okay. So you need to understand the study, though. And this is why. So the last note here then is Myers-Briggs. And this is where I say, okay, I think that the results here were kind of predictable. And the reason why I say that is because Myers-Briggs is known, and the study says this within their results. They specifically have a caveat that says, yes, we know that Myers-Briggs is really controversial because it doesn't seem to actually be a good evaluation of your personality, true personality, like in internal motivations. The five traits, if you're familiar with that one, is the one that most claim to be, that's quite scientific and is fairly consistent in terms of its predictive capabilities. But Myers-Briggs is not. It's terrible, actually. And here's the reason. It's highly contextual, context dependent, which means if you take the Myers-Briggs test when you're like hanging out with your family at home and you're thinking about home life, you're going to get way different results than if you take it at work where you're like in a cubicle with a bunch of other people low on the totem pole. Or if you take the personality test when you're just after winning a race. It's going to be very different than just after having a really bad workout. So the point is the Myers-Briggs test is going to be able to produce results that show something like this, and it's going to mean nothing. And so that, and then you get into like other things like mood and stuff. And the reason why I'm saying that is because the same things that corrupt the Myers-Briggs results also corrupt your running mechanic results. Your mood when you run, your current self-perception when you run, the people around you, your context when you run, are all affecting your running mechanics. And you can look at that. You can study this all the different ways you want to try to study it. And it's really consistent. And it's something like, get a crowd of people, like four or five, who are going to run together, right? Tell three of them that while you run today, have a little extra bounce, like stand up straighter and just bounce a bit more when you run. And don't tell the other person. They're going to have more of that in that run too.
Because I wonder if we can come up with more ideas. Tell someone that at the end of their run that you're going to give them $50.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
They're probably going to have more of a pep in their step.
Right.
Probably going to feel a little better on the run.
So this is why I have problems with the study. I read through the study in depth. It's abundantly clear that the author of the Runner's World article only read the abstract, because every bit of information the author shares is in the abstract and the author shares nothing outside of that. So that's a problem. Like if you're gonna report on a study in Runner's World, read more of the study, please. Because you get into other things like, so they make the claim, the researchers make the claim that, or their conclusion is that the sensor intuitor stuff is where you see the biggest predictive element of running mechanics. The sensors all demonstrated kind of more of one thing, and the intuitors all demonstrated kind of more of another thing, in terms of like the way they were running. And then you start to look at the data and it's like, oh my goodness, they're like almost the same, like the standard deviation. They're both within their own margins of error. And then you also look at the spread of data and it's huge. So it's like, okay, you're getting these averages from like runners are all over the board in terms of how they're running. And you just take the average of that and say, well, it's a little different than the average of the other one, which is also all over the board. And I look at that and I'm like, that's terrible science. It's just bad. So my conclusion after I read their study, which they drew conclusions from, is the exact opposite of theirs, which is you cannot predict running mechanics from the Myers-Briggs test results. Not to suggest that personality doesn't have a connection with some of these things, but the Myers-Briggs approach is not the one that's going to prove it, at least in this case.
My takeaway is let's keep working on honing our inner talk, as we've been talking about.
Good.
Previous yeah, good. To mm-hmm. our conversations about variables. So we talked about humidity and we talked about this previous week. We talked about wind. And then before that, we had Dakota Lindworm, which tied together a great talk about our self-talk and our mindset. So go back and listen to those, because that truly might help you in a positive way. So.
And if you want to make connections between your running mechanics and other aspects of life, the other piece that's imperative here to understand is that your running mechanic is improvable. It is rather malleable. You can change it. And so what's odd is the final conclusion of the article, which states, I'm going to read this one, specifically says, these results suggest that runners with sensing and intuition personality traits differ in their ability to use their lower limb structures as springs. What? No, they don't. Maybe they have a predisposition at best, which I disagree with, if and that's not even the claim. But their ability? That's absurd. So my conclusion after reading through all this, it goes back to the heart of these things can be improved upon. And if there are individual variations, which of course there are abundantly, then there are individual solutions that are going to help us to improve upon them. So don't relegate yourself, because my personality is one thing, to say all hope is lost and I'm not going to run as well as somebody else. That is not true.
Mm-hmm. I think the reason that this research was done and why Runner's World published is because people love those personality test things, and they're like, am I a turtle? Am I an elephant? Or am I a seal?
I hate that stuff.
You know what I mean? So I think that that's probably part of the reason that they created this like personalities and running conversation. So that's my guess on that. But
I heard about that trend once.
Yeah.
It's apparently a thing that happens on Facebook
a lot. It's still a trend. It's still a trend. People love to take personality tests. And if you like to do that, there's no shame in that.
I'm not saying there's shame in it. I'm just saying it's kind of funny to me.
We're talking about mood. We're talking about personality. I have to say it, and I say it all the time, but one thing that you can do to improve your mood and your performance while running is to keep your eyes up. So there you go. There's a nice, tangible takeaway. Okay. Eyes up.
You got it.
It will improve your mood and your mechanics.
Speaking of nice tangible takeaways, if you want us to address things specific to you, you can ask your questions by sending them via email to questions@a2zrunning.com. Do that now. Do that anytime. Do it as much as you like. And we'll share thoughts and we'll put it on the podcast and it will be loads of fun.
Thank you all for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week.